UN pyramid.
90 UN peacekeepers in South Lebanon have tested positive for the novel coronavirus, a UN spokesman said on Sunday. The confirmed cases were transferred to a special UN facility equipped to deal with COVID-19 cases, spokesman Andrea Tenenti said in a statement. He added that 88 of those infected belonged to the same contingent, but he did not specify the nationalities of the infected peacekeepers. Some 45 countries contribute peacekeepers to UNIFIL, which was set up in 1978 to patrol the border between Lebanon and Israel, which are technically at war. Tenenti said its operations are not affected by the new virus cases. Lebanon has seen a spike in the number of confirmed coronavirus cases since an August 4th explosion ripped through the Beirut port, killing more than 190 people and devastating large sections of the capital. Meanwhile, Lebanon has approved a new work contract allowing foreign domestic workers to resign and keep hold of their own passports. Lebanon is home to around 250,000 migrants, mostly women from Africa and Asia, who often work in people's homes as housekeepers and nannies. They're not protected by the country's labor laws, but instead work under a set of policies and customs called kafala, which have been repeatedly criticized by rights groups as allowing a wide range of abuse by employers. Lebanon's economic and coronavirus crises have increased the urgency for reform over the past year, with many families now paying their workers in the devalued local currency and some not at all. The International Labor Organization, ILO, called the new contract a, quote, step in the right direction, and a deal establishing relations between Israel and Bahrain will result in direct flights between the two countries, Israeli Prime Minister has said. This is VOA News. Protesters in Libya's second city, Benghazi, set fire to the headquarters of the parallel Eastern administration controlled by strongman Khalifa Haftar, a security source said Sunday. Protests also erupted in the eastern town of Al-Marj, with police opening fire after demonstrators forced their way into the police station. Recent protests in Libya have been mainly in the western region, in the capital Tripoli, seat of the UN-recognized Government of National Accord, or GNA, a rival power base to Haftar. However, protests began late Thursday in Benghazi in the east as anger has erupted over power cuts, cash shortages, and high fuel prices. The main military fault line in this North African nation is between forces loyal to the GNA and those backing Haftar, who launched an offensive to seize Tripoli last year, but was beaten off by Turkish-backed GNA forces. Libya, which sits on the continent's biggest crude oil reserves, has endured almost a decade of violent chaos since the 2011 NATO-backed uprising that toppled and killed dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar said Sunday that the return of the seismic research vessel Aruk Reis to near the country's southern shores does not mean Ankara has given up on its rights in the eastern Mediterranean. Speaking to the state-owned Anadolu News Agency, Akar said the ship's movement was part of its scheduled operations. The ship returned to waters near the southern province of Antalya on Sunday, a move Greece said was a positive step in easing tensions over offshore natural resources. And Thai authorities have summoned the heads of universities to tell them to stop students demanding reform of the monarchy, warning that such calls could lead to violence, a member of the military-appointed Senate said on Sunday. Thailand has faced near-daily protests since mid-July, calling for the departure of Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha, a former junta leader, and for a new constitution and elections. Some groups have also listed demands to curb the powers of the king and the royal palace, which breaks a long-standing taboo in the South Asian country. And the Los Angeles Lakers are going to the conference finals for the first time in a decade, ending the longest drought in franchise history. LeBron James is going for the first time since 2018. For him, that also qualifies as an ending a drought. James scored 29 points, and the Lakers wrapped up their first trip to the Western Conference Finals since 2010 by topping the Houston Rockets on Saturday night. James is going to the Conference Finals for the 11th time. Here remote, I'm Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I think we'll have to wait to see who is going to be president. If it's going to be from M5, probably the reaction will be different. Otherwise, we'll see different reaction. But it's too early for me to say what would be their thoughts on the conclusions right now.
Malian talks to lead to the formation of a civilian transitional government ends Saturday.
So it's so easy for us to monitor and know that when they are not working, and once they are not working, we are going to call their attention. We're going to ensure that accountability and transparency is being followed as we address SGBV and rape cases in Liberia.
Liberian President George Weah announces new measures to combat rape.
It's up to the Minister of Education, the Minister of Higher Education, because it also involves the universities and colleges, to ensure that these guidelines are followed. And the President said he emphasized that you must ensure that guidelines are followed so that the kids are safe in school. So the guidelines will be followed.
And Zambian President Edgar Lungu announces plans to reopen schools as the coronavirus infection rate slows in the country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Mali, talks to lead to the formation of a civilian transitional government ends in the capital Bamako Saturday. Pressured by the Economic Community of West African State, ECOWAS, a regional bloc, and the African Union, the military junta held talks with opposition and civil society groups. ECOWAS wants the junta to hand over power to a civilian-led transitional administration to organize an election. The regional bloc, which has a policy of zero tolerance for the overthrow of a legitimately elected government, imposed sanctions on Mali. This after the military threw out President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita's government in a coup. Local media reports there was an agreement for a transitional government to be led by a civilian following the dialogue, which ended Saturday. To get more reaction about the talks, I reached Salif Tigana, CEO of Tigana Technology, in the capital, Bamako.
Yesterday, there were a proposition from the military that says that they wanted a president to be a military, and the transition to take 2 years. But today, in the conclusions, they have concluded in the first point that they highlighted the role played by the M5, and in second, they have decided that the president will be civilian. And there will be a vice president that will be a military, mainly in charge of security. And there will be a PM that will be designated by a president, the civilian president. That's the conclusion. That's the part of what I got from the conclusion. Not the whole, but just some summary of the conclusions.
Salif, we heard there were initial disagreement about the way forward in forming the civilian administration demanded by ECOWAS. Tell me what you heard.
Yeah, I heard a lot of people saying that the military should comply with the ECOWAS because most of the politicians would like to see the civilian running the transition, because they said the situation in Mali right now is such that we are in difficulty and we cannot handle sanctions. And if sanctions stay there, the situation will become worse. So they said it is better that the military accept the civilian president. That was the main point from a lot of people. There was in national television last night, journalists went out and asked the people about what they thought. And mainly people said, well, if ECOWAS wants a civilian president in order to release the sanctions, then let's let it be so.
How are Malians reacting to how the talks ended on Saturday?
Right now, it's too early to know what in overall Malians think about. But I guess most of Malians will be satisfied because the fact that the president will be a civilian. But the part of Malian would probably not be happy if that civilian will be a politician, because they're like, hey, the politicians have to wait and they can come to power through the election, but not because of the coup d'etat. So we're going to have to wait to see who is going to be that civilian president. If he's a politician, then the situation, I mean, it will be a different thing.
But do you think the military junta, from the talks that they've held, they will still hand over power within 12 months as demanded by ECOWAS?
I think it is possible. It will depend on what is the mission, what are the mission they are going to assign to themselves. For example, if their mission is to just to make sure that we do political reforms, election reforms and all of those things, and also to make sure that there will be a fair election, then that's good. I think it will be possible. But if they wanted to, refound Mali, if they want to, ideologically speaking, you know, political ideology, if they want to go on that path, then it will be very hard to come up with anything in 2 months, two years. That would be too short to do it. But if the mission is just to make sure we have reforms and then we have a fair election, then it's possible.
You have friends in the M5 opposition coalition that organized a series of demonstrations pressuring former President IBK or Ibrahim Boubacar Keita that led to the coup. Are they satisfied with the talks that ended on Saturday so far? What did you hear?
Yeah, according to my friend that I just talked to from the palais where the talk is held, they are satisfied because they have succeeded to highlight the role played by the M5 in a document. And I don't know what that would mean practically. What that would mean practically, does that mean that the president is going to come from M5 or the prime minister? I don't know. But I think we'll have to wait to see who is going to be president. If he's going to be from M5, probably the reaction will be different. Otherwise, we will see different reaction. But it's too early for me to say what would be their thoughts on the conclusions right now.
Salif Tigana is the CEO of Tigana Technology. He spoke with me from the Malian capital, Bamako. The executive director of Community Healthcare Initiative, a women's rights group, has welcomed Liberian President George Weah's announcement that he will address the sharp rise in cases of rape. Naomi Tule Solanke says a recent two-day conference on the need to tackle sexual violence appeared to have pressured the president to come up with solutions to combat the increase in the reported number of cases. Her remarks come after President Weah announced new measures to combat the spike, including naming a special prosecutor and the creation of a national database for sex offenders. Women's and human rights groups have condemned what they say is the increase in sexual violence against women. However, the groups say they had expected the president to have acted sooner to serve as a deterrent to offenders. Naomi Tule Solanke, the executive director of Community Healthcare Initiative, tells me that women's groups will pressure the government to keep its promise to combat the problem.
First of all, this is very, very, very important to the women and children of Liberia. This is what we have asked. And we have asked this question not because it's difficult, because we have asked, looking at the current situation in the country, the increase, imagine 900 plus raped cases, and 60% of this amount, just between the month of January to March, 60% of these cases are children. And yet and still the government was so quiet, like, it was normalized that it was okay for children and women to be raped. Now that the president have taken this visible action, we as women's rights actor and human rights defender, women's human rights defender, are happy because it's a first step to achieving what we want to ensure that all forms of violence are eliminated against women and children in the country.
Now, Ms. Naomi, late on Friday, the president said he would install a special prosecutor for rape as well as set up a national sex offender registry. He would also establish a so-called National Security Task Force on sexual and gender-based violence. Do you think these are steps in the right direction to address this?
These are all concrete actions right now. What we will be looking for in the coming days is to see visible action. For this one, we as human rights defenders going to hold the government feet to the fire, in the sense that we're going to ensure that everything that they have mentioned is being implemented. Because it is important, we need to ensure that we have a task force that is creating awareness so the people in the community cannot compromise rape cases. We need to ensure that there are speedy trials so the survivor themselves can have closure to what has happened to them.
Naomi, do you think the recent conference on tackling sexual violence, which took place on Wednesday, as well as recent protests, forced the president's hand to come up with such measures?
Yes, the recent protests actually forced the president, and not just one of the protests. The facts are there. There are an increase in sexual gender-based violence in Liberia, especially rape. And seeing that the outrage in the community, the young people taking the lead in demanding that the president take a visible action, that the president now start to ensure that all rights of its citizens are protected, including women and children, that their rights have been violated. So I feel that it is good that he listened to the protester, in as much as he refused to come for the petition. But it is good that he's also adhering to some of those demands, because even over the period of the 2 days conference, everything began to repeat itself. Like, these are reality. These are facts. We need to ensure that we support the justice system. So now, what we need to do is to follow up all of the demands he has made in public. So we, as citizens, we are women human rights defenders. It is on us to ensure that government is in compliance to everything that they have promised, or ensure that the life of women and children are protected and they are justice.
How are you going to hold the government accountable with this statement coming from the president?
Peter, that is very easy for us, because one of the things is that we're going to monitor. We're going to ensure that there is a tax force form. We're going to monitor. We're going to put a meter up in like 20 days to the president's promises. We are going to track his promises. We are also going to ensure that the code, that the special code, is being established. We are going to ensure that the justice system is being working effectively. There are speedy trials, because we have currently, we have like, it takes up to 50 days before one case can be tried. We want speedy trial of cases. We need to ensure that the people that has been booked for rape are actually booked for the right reason. So we are going to follow up and ensure that all of these promises are being implemented, because with the survivor needs safe homes. We are going to be taking survivors to the government. So it's so easy for us to monitor and know that when they are not working. And once they are not working, we are going to call their attention. We're going to ensure that accountability and transparency is being followed as we address SGBV and rape cases in Liberia.
Naomi Tule Solanke is the Executive Director of Community Healthcare Initiative. She spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. In Nigeria, Delta State has established its first new state house of assembly for the youth in the capital, Asaba. Officials say the parliament forms part of the effort to strengthen youth development in the oil and agricultural producing state. Representing the governor at the inauguration of the youth parliament, Chief Fukekeme Solomon, a political advisor to the governor, welcomed the move as a positive development, which he says will enable the youth to gain knowledge about governance. He says the parliament forms part of a capacity-building effort to enable the youth to be more self-aware, to build their confidence, as well as develop leadership skills. Solomon tells me that the youth parliament would help enable the governor to effectively address their concerns, including unemployment.
So the aim of involving the youth at this early time is to show them the rigors of lawmaking, the processes of policy formulation, and then arriving at implementable conclusions that will further strengthen government activities and programs.
You know that several governments come up with very lofty ideas, they implement them, but they are not sustainable. How different is this, and how sustainable will this be, even if the governor leaves office after serving his 2 terms?
Yeah. We know that that fuzzy month be one of the things that affects the programs. But what we have done now, first of all, you know that the protocols signed in ECOWAS and UN about the place of youth in governance. And so those protocols have already guided us, and then we are determined to ensure that this program is sustained even after the governor leaves office by putting appropriate institutional frameworks, which the review of the policies that we have as an assembly, sit as an assembly, who will take it as one of the conclusions that is part of the government.
Are you therefore saying the governor has, or his state government has institutionalized this to ensure that no other governor will come in, you know, by a stroke of a pen, just scrap it or just dismantle it?
Yes. Well, yeah, it has been institutionalized, and that is why it was formally inaugurated.
So tell me, how has been the response of the youth following the establishment of this?
Yes, we are happy about it. The reactions we have gotten so far shows that they're very excited. They're happy about their involvement in policy formulation, and they're very happy about that. And then so far, right now, it's based on the constituency. The member representing the constituency in the State House of Assembly will consult the constituency to produce a youth that will represent them. But in future, I think that the rules that are being prepared now, it will be taken more formally in the process of emerging as to who will represent them in the parliament.
In order to qualify to become a member of the Delta Youth National Assembly, what criteria do you have to meet? What requirement do you have to meet in order to be elected or chosen by your peers to represent them in the National Assembly?
Well, the basic qualifications of first age, and then basic qualifications as provided in the Constitution. That are two qualifications. And then some other things through intensive screening, and then the processes of having basic knowledge about representation, about rules, about the Constitution. These are the criteria.
So what is the message here to the people of Delta, particularly the youth, with this institution of the Youth National Assembly in Delta State?
Yeah, by the institution of the Youth Parliament in Delta State, first and foremost, youth are now being called upon to channel their grievances, channel their concerns through the Youth Assembly to the government. And that will call youth restiveness or self-help. They now have an opportunity to be heard. And so they have a forum in the parliament to be able to discuss the issues that concerns them. And so they are being called upon now to resist from vices, you know, violence, you know, self-help. It's not like necessary because there's no platform. They thought now they could complain that they have no platform to voice their concern. Now we have now. So every youth is not being called upon to take advantage of this youth parliament to begin to present their grievances, their concerns, their needs, their other needs, needs of unemployment, and all that. All those needs. The result will be that the state will become more peaceful because the dialogue will take over violence and self-help.
Chief Fukenkemi Solomon is a political advisor to Nigeria's Delta State Governor. He spoke with me from the Delta State's capital, Asaba. The president of Zambia, Edgar Lungu, has announced the reopening of schools and bars in a State of a Nation address Friday. The announcement follows official reports showing that cases of the novel coronavirus have slowed. The president says tertiary institutions, including colleges and universities, will be reopened from September 14 and 23. He also announced a partial reopening of bars, but warned that medical guidelines, including social distancing and frequent hand washing, should be observed. Isaac Chipampe is the spokesperson for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He tells me that the president also called for civility among politicians ahead of next year's elections.
The president generally talked about the effect of COVID-19 and how COVID-19 has affected the economy and households, generally the Zambian people. And then, but he also talked about other sectors and how we are doing generally in the other sectors. But I think the major point that Zambians have picked, obviously, is the reopening of schools and these outlets, bars and these nightclubs. Those were the talking points that many Zambians took.
Well, Isaac, does that mean that health measures the government has implemented has been able to limit the spread of the coronavirus, for which the president depended on to ease some movement restrictions?
Yes, I think, let me just say that the COVID-19 has had a serious impact, especially when we were in the cold season. So we had a lot of cases during this time, and we are just praying that maybe now that it's a bit warmer, will be saved from this pandemic. But the Zambian people have generally adhered to the guidelines by the Minister of Health, which is obviously the masking. If you come to Zambia, we notice that a lot of people are masking for some time now. The closure of schools definitely helped, and obviously the closure of these public places. But the impact it has had is devastating on the population, especially the business people.
Isaac, I understand a lot of Zambians welcome the reopening of schools, but would there be any other guidelines from the health ministry as part of an effort to limit the spread of the coronavirus in schools? I ask this because in some other places around the world, when schools reopened, there were sharp rises of cases of the coronavirus, of the disease. So what would be different in Zambia?
Yes, actually the reopening of schools has been guided by the Ministry of Education itself. By the way, the examination classes had been going to school, and we didn't have any reports of significant cases of COVID-19 in the schools, whether high density or low density. This is because the government spent so much money and resources to ensure that the kids were masked and they were observing social distancing and so forth. So based on that, the permanent secretary thought it wise that the president needed to look at reopening, which he has done. And now it is up to the Minister of Education, the Minister of Higher Education, because it also involves the universities and colleges, to ensure that these guidelines are followed. And the president said, he emphasized that you must ensure that guidelines are followed so that the kids are safe in school. So the guidelines will be followed.
After the president's speech about lifting some restrictions and movement across the country, what's next?
I think the people are rejuvenated. They always happy when the president speaks and he has spoken. I think generally so far the speech has been welcomed. I think the major thing to take from the speech also is the hope that the president has given the Zambian people, that he still believes that despite the COVID-19, the impact of COVID-19 on the economy will be turned around, especially next year. And I think people generally have liked it that he also, you know, welcomed unity among the political players. As you know, we are going into elections next year in August. So he called for peace and civilized campaigns and so forth. So the speech was really not antagonistic. It was a speech where he was offering an olive branch to the political opponents. And I think that's how it should be. He was not personal. He was speaking as a national leader.
Isaac Chipampe is the spokesperson for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka.
Take your pick, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Fali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, Gambia's Market Union has been meeting with the government to find a way to ease the COVID-19 lockdown that has left small traders with virtually no sales. For VOA Pan, Derry Mbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The national lockdown has been extended on numerous occasions to save lives. But small business owners say the restrictions are killing businesses. Yande Sise is a vegetable seller at the Sherekunda Market, one of the biggest in the Greater Banjul area. Speaking in the local Wolof language, she said the lockdown is causing hunger. She said the lockdown has devastated her business. She says she can hardly sleep at night because she can pay her rent. She also says she doesn't have money to feed her family. My son, we are really suffering here. We are tired. We really need help, she said. The market union wanted to organize a sit-down strike this past week and keep their shops closed unless the government relaxes the limit on operation hours and makes other changes. Bubakar Sankano, a senior information ministry official, says no changes can be made until the lockdown regulation expires.
There's a legal challenge here. At this point in time, you know, all the regulations are gazetted. And then if you just amend it like that, you know, I mean, it will be done, but legally, you know, it's going to be questionable. So the consensus is that, you know, let them all be here until when we have the next regulation, then we can consider all of these grievances.
Fish seller Hadige says her fish are spoiling as the lockdown drags on. She said business owners in the Gambia are suffering. For example, she said the time they can be open is too short for them to be able to sell their fish. She says the unsold fish would often get spoiled because access to electricity is a problem. Trader Fatou Njai has urged the government to come to their rescue. She said sales have dropped and they are finding it difficult to pay their bills. She said the president doesn't pay rent, that he is living on taxpayers' expense. We are different from Barrow. We pay rent and feed our families. Businesswoman Yama Mbai imports textiles from China and Dubai. She is also a salon owner.
In 7 4 hours, when you may three by seven, man, some of us are not together. I'm not only here, I'm a section of plus known because of I'm Dalap. I think many stop.
She said she is closing her shop to protest the lockdown. She says she has not been making sales. She says her shop's location is not a crowded location of the market. She urged the government to reopen the country and allow businesses to operate, or many businesses will close for good. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The campaign manager for the Tanzanian opposition party, ACT Wazalendo, says the party faces difficulties following the disqualification of its endorsed representatives ahead of the upcoming October elections. Emmanuel Mvula says the disqualifications forced the party's presidential candidate, Bernard Membe, to delay campaigning in the run-up to the polls. He, however, says the party relaunched its campaign this weekend before the elections. Political analysts say the delays are likely to affect the party's electoral prospects. They also say opposition parties appear to be faced with a financial crunch because they may not be able to compete with the financial muscle of the governing party, the Chama Chama Pinduzi or CCM. But Emmanuel Mvula, campaign manager for the opposition ACT Wazalendo, tells me the party will be competitive in the upcoming elections despite the setbacks.
Campaign going on not in schedule. we have been hit by a result which came out during the nomination day. So you may find that our campaign has been greatly affected by this because, as you know, we launched our campaign in Lindi on the 1st, but our presidential candidate go on with the campaign because nearly in all the constituencies around Lindi and Mtwara, our candidates were disqualified. So it greatly affected our timetable. We had to go back to the National Election Commission for the timetable to be amended, and then we hopefully by this weekend we'll kick off the campaign on the presidential campaign.
Evula, with all these challenges you are having, how competitive do you think ACT Wazalendo will be, particularly with the presidential election?
We'll be very competitive. Our candidate is the best candidate. Our manifesto is the best one. We have the best team of campaigners, the top leadership and the campaign team. So at the end of the day, when we kick off, we are confident that we will be very competitive and we will win the election.
A lot of opposition parties are complaining about financial crunch and that they might not necessarily have the money for the rest of the campaign before the elections. Do you have the financial support to be competitive in the elections?
Currently, we spend our budget, as we budgeted, is enough. We have enough resources to run the campaign. We might have the deficit up here and there, but they are normal and manageable. So we call upon our partners, the provincials, our members, and the citizens in general to contribute. But generally, our budget is as good as to run the campaign successfully. If there is leadership, that is where it's manageable. But the main part the main part of the budget is there and we can run the campaign.
Has the Electoral Commission resolved all your concerns and complaints you have with the disqualification of your other candidates in the parliamentary and local?
The Electoral Commission in Tanzania has not done enough. The officers in the constituencies favored CCM in every way, from the issuing of the forms, receiving them during the return of the form, the nomination, and even after the nomination, the disqualification and so forth. The National Electoral Commission and its commissions on different levels have not provided a fair field. Has been very unfair to opposition parties. And generally, they are favoring the government and CCM and the Court of Appeal. So we are still fighting. The commission is not free, it cannot run a free and fair election.
Some people are saying if the stance of ACT Wazalendo is that the Electoral Commission is biased and in favor of the ruling Chama Chama Pinduzi party, why do you participate in an election that you say will neither be free nor fair?
In the revolution struggle, you use all the means available. Once Meles Zenawi said that we fight while talking and we talk while fighting. So we're doing the same. Until we find that one means or one only one way to go, that is where we'll choose one. But for now, we're using both. And we'll follow the avenues available. And if not, then we'll go to the other means to demand for the democracy.
Emmanuel Mvula is the campaign manager for the Tanzanian opposition party, ACT Wazalendo. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. V The Malawian government has moved to put into operation the Access to Information Law 4 years after the bill passed the country's parliament. This following the official publication of the law Friday by the information minister, while the Malawi chapter of the Media Watchdog, Media Institute for Southern Africa, welcomes the move, it warns the government against deliberately stifling enforcement of the law. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
Malawi's National Assembly passed the Access to Information Bill in December 2016, and former President Peter Mutharika approved it in 2017. However, the law had never been put into operation despite a push from rights bodies. In 2018, Media Institute of Southern Africa in Malawi threatened legal action against the government for failure to implement the legislation which aimed at giving people easy access to public information. Gospel Kazako, the government spokesperson in the administration of current President Lazarus Chakwera, told VOA Saturday the move to put the law into effect is a step toward the end of the secretive operations of government and public institutions.
There will be a lot of discipline in how government conducts its business. Certainly, resources will be used in the manner that the people of this country would like them to be. As we're doing that, it means we'll be developing.
Teresa Ndanga, chairperson for the Media Institute for Southern Africa in Malawi, says the move will help the media and members of the public seek, receive, and impart information with legal backing.
Because the information that we get at the moment is really at the mercy of whoever is giving you that information. But with the Access to Information Law, they will have a specified period of time through which they will have to give out that information. And at the expiry of 15 days, if they don't give a response or explain why they haven't given you the information, then you may take action on it.
However, Ndanga warns government against deliberately stifling implementation of the law by underfunding institutions responsible for overseeing its implementation.
I think for the government, they need to demonstrate action now, commitment by doing. The Malawi Human Rights Commission, which is the oversight body, has not been getting resources to prepare for the implementation. And we do expect that in this particular budget, they will allocate enough resources to the Malawi Human Rights Commission to enable it to oversee the implementation process.
Government spokesperson Kazako says measures are already in place to ensure smooth and full implementation of the law starting September 30. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's kick off with football. The Burundian and Tanzania Premier Leagues were the first on the African continent to kick off their 2020-2021 season after the heavy disruptions caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. The two East African nations were also the first to resume for the remainder of the 2019-2020 season in July. Burundi got the new campaign off positively last Saturday, while in Tanzania, the return of the top-flight football was greeted by full-to-capacity crowds across the country. The defending champions Simba Sports Club were off to a good start, winning 2-1 against league newcomers Ihayefu in Mbeya. Elsewhere, Simba's arch-rivals, Yanga, started their campaign on a low after drawing 1-1 at home against Tanzania Prisons at the Benjamin Mkapa Stadium in Dar es Salaam. Elsewhere, Senegal has lined up two friendlies against Morocco and Mauritania. The Teranga Lions will travel to face Morocco's Atlas Lions in Rabat on October 9th. Before hosting Mauritania 4 days later, the two matches will serve as a build-up to November's Africa Cup of Nations Cameroon 2021 qualifier against Guinea-Bissau. Both matches will be played behind closed doors
in line with established health protocols due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Senegal leads the pack in Group I on 6 points, thanks to victories against Congo, which was 2-0, and Eswatini, which was 4-1. In athletics, at the 2020 Ostrava Golden Spike, Jacob Kiplimo came from behind to stun Salomon Barega in a thrilling 5,000 meters as both men broke the 12 minutes 50 seconds mark. The 19-year-old Ugandan Kiplimo won with a timing of 12:48.63 on Tuesday in the Czech Republic. The former junior world champion pulled off a stunning come from behind to beat Ethiopia's world championship silver medalist Salomon Barega. He mounted an assault on Steven Chorono's meet record of 12:48.81. Barega came in second at 12:49.08. Kiplimo has also elevated his profile high enough with 3 world records in 9 months to add to last year's 5,000 meters Diamond League trophy, the world cross-country title, and the world 10,000 meters gold. Kiplimo's victory comes in less than a month after Ugandan icon Joshua Cheptegei made history by breaking a 16-year-old 5,000 meters world record with 12:35.36 at the Monaco Diamond League in August. Meanwhile, on Saturday, four-time Olympic champion Mo Farah won the Antrim Coastal Half Marathon held in Northern Ireland's coastline. Farah followed up the other week's one-hour world record run in Brussels on his return to the track with another impressive display. In boxing, four-weight world champion Saul Canelo Alvarez is suing streaming service DAZN and promoter Oscar De La Hoya for at least $280 million. The Mexican is suing for breach of the single largest contract in the history of boxing. In 2018, Alvarez signed a $365 million deal for 11 fights on DAZN. Alvarez has lost once in 56 fights since turning professional in 2005. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Kiuno, 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 ki
mapenzi na nikosha zako kachiri piga kufuli tuwe wawili kwenye giza nijokoe hey kachiri kachiri sanikosha zako kachiri piga kufuli tuwe wawili kwenye giza nijokoe haina
Africa, Ilo Piano, Caribbean. Shake your body as a scream and shout. Life is too short. No matter where you come from, Africa is your home. Scream and shout. Come dance with me. Chesa, 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 Mizuki, chesa. Chesa, 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 man of Africa. Chesa, 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 Baba, chesa. Chesa, 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 man of Africa.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, those who never protect the values of their ancestors, their soul will never rest peacefully. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.